Frontline, Saving Lives in War, Disaster and Disease, is the new book from Dr. Tony Redman. If you don't know who Dr. Redman is, his is a story of tireless hard work and astonishing bravery across wars, refugee crisis, air crashes, earthquakes, typhoons, volcanoes, and disease outbreaks over 30 years. For decades, he's performed incredible feats of altruism. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from somewhere in the UK, Dr. Tony Redman himself. Tony, good morning to you.
Good morning. Good morning.
It's to those who just sort of casually glance at the front cover of the book, when it says Tales of War, Disaster, Disease, Air Crash, it might seem a book that would, be a disturbing, if not disheartening read. But of course, in the midst of all the chaos and disaster, there is good to be found. There are stories of altruism and bravery and humanity.
That's what I want to get over in the book. These are distressing events, but I want people to see that there are lots of people who show everyday bravery, who go out there day after day, year upon year, responding to help people in their times of greatest need. And people often ask me, you've seen so much over the years, it must have a terrible effect on you. And to some extent, that's true. It would be wrong to say that I'm not affected. I have a heart like everybody else. But what I'm more affected by is just how good people are, how people will respond, how people themselves, those affected, will try their very best to get over it. I remember very, very early on, being at an earthquake in Iran, actually at a time when we didn't have diplomatic relations with them as the UK, and we were invited in by the Iranian Red Crescent. We didn't have visas or anything like that.
Was that the one that took out, was it the town of Bam? Was it that earthquake?
This was the one before. There was one in Rasht, which was an even bigger one. But because Iran was so politically isolated at the time, the international response was very limited. But we managed to get in, and we were very well received by the Iranians. But I can remember feeling there were so many injured people, there were so many difficult decisions that we had to make about who to operate on first and so on. And one of the local doctors saw me looking sad and berated me. He said, "This is our disaster. We will get over it. We will make things better. If you're here to help, help us. Don't stand around looking sad. Just roll your sleeves up and get on with it." And it was almost like a slap across the face. But he was absolutely right. And you see, people will get over these things and will respond. And then we work very closely with the Iranian nurses and doctors, so closely, in fact, that when the Kurdish refugee crisis happened the year afterwards, the Iranian government invited us back to set up a field hospital high up in the mountains on the Iran-Iraq border.
What appealed to you, if that's the right word, to because you were originally, was it Nightingale Hospital in Manchester that you were originally involved in?
No, that's what I did last year. I was a medical director of the Nightingale Hospital in Manchester because I'd worked on the Ebola response in Sierra Leone, and I've set up field hospitals all over the world. I set them up in Kosovo, so I know how to do that. My team knows how to do that.
How did you get into, or how did you decide, right, this is the
how
path?
Did I get into the,
yeah.
I trained in A&E, accident and emergency medicine, or emergency medicine as now refer to it. I was one of the first consultants in the UK in what was then a very new specialty. And as part of that interest, I also wanted to look at care before patients got to hospital. So we set up one of the first paramedic training schemes in the UK. We had to raise the money ourselves for the defibrillators. And we set that up in Manchester, and ended up at one time, the Greater Manchester paramedic system was the largest in the UK. Everywhere's caught up now. But by working in the pre-hospital phase, I realized that the hospitals stop short at the hospital door. So how do you get medical staff in support of the ambulance service? So we set up a system of volunteers. So people, surgeons, nurses, anaesthetists, who were already working in the NHS, they had to be free to help the ambulance service. So we asked them to volunteer to do extra on call for no pay and to raise the money for their own equipment. And we weren't short of volunteers. People came forward. So we set up what was called the South Manchester Accident Rescue Team, and that helped the ambulance service. So when a very large earthquake occurred in Armenia in 1988, we were asked by the British government, would we send the team in support of the wider aid effort? So that was the first time I got involved internationally.
And what was it like then, the first time? Because you say now, you know, you've done this before, you've done field hospitals, yeah. You kind of know the process. But that first time, as a younger man, shall we say, going in there with a team, not really knowing the area, because these tend to be remote parts of the world, especially with earthquakes and natural disasters. I mean, did you just sort of sit there and go, good grief, you know, what have we got ourselves into?
In short, yes. And what struck me was I was an A&E consultant and I'd seen lots of difficult things and I thought I was quite resilient, but at the scale, I just wasn't prepared for the scale of it. There were somewhere between 25 and 100,000 people killed, and we were going up a mountain to the scene of the earthquake, and the only other vehicles in our convoy were vehicles full of empty coffins just going in to pick up the dead. It was horrendous, and it was compounded by the fact that on the way home, our team was diverted to the Lockerbie air disaster, where I was site medical officer. So in the space of 1 month, I'd gone to one of the largest sudden-onset disasters of the 20th century, and then on the way home to the biggest terrorist attack in the UK.
And you talk about, you know, being shocked and being told just to get on with it, but something like Lockerbie, which was truly shocking, and the devastation on the ground. I mean, can anything prepare you for a man-made disaster like that?
No, and what struck me about that, I've only really had persisting nightmares about two events. One was Lockerbie, and the other was I spent 5 years working in Sarajevo throughout the war. And that gave me nightmares. And it was the fact that it was both of them were deliberate. That's so hard to accept. An earthquake occurs. Okay, poor countries are more vulnerable because they can't build resistant structures. So there is an element of man-made in it. But a terrorist attack, a civil war where snipers were shooting people on the street, where snipers were shooting at me, I found that very, very difficult to deal with, that level of callousness and brutality.
And the thing with Kosovo, Sarajevo, was the fact that here was, to all intents and purposes, and I'm not, this might come out the wrong way, but when you have a disaster that happens in Africa or in Central Asia, it's seen as over there. But with Kosovo, and because I've spoken with friends who were working with War Child and photographers and stuff over there, they were saying the problem was this was a European city. This wasn't
absolutely.
This was like it happening in Manchester or it happening in Bristol. It was the same reference points.
Yeah. Tovel and Dean had won the Winter Olympics in Sarajevo only a few years before. It's extraordinary. And Sarajevo had all the air of cafe culture, a very, very civilized city. And I went there right at the start and I stayed right until the end, and I just saw it destroyed. And the same in Kosovo. I moved on from Sarajevo to Kosovo, and then from Kosovo, I moved on to the civil war in Sierra Leone. And it's just seeing you know, the harm that people will do to each other. But even within that, the enormous resilience of people and the goodness that still shines through, people still try and look after each other.
It's interesting you mentioned Sierra Leone, because we had the Ebola outbreak in Sierra Leone and we had the civil war in Sierra Leone. And this is not all about me, but I've got lots of good friends who are from that particular part of the world. And it is a beautiful place. The beaches are amazing. The countryside is glorious. And the people are warm and welcoming me and want to show you their culture.
Yes. I mean, In the Civil War, it was heartbreaking to walk along the beach, beautiful white sands, and you can see they tried to get a tourist industry going. It would have been a wonderful place, but there's all these derelict, wrecked hotels, half built, some almost completed and then destroyed. Beachside cafes never opened, And it's so near, within grasp, for such a, you know, could have been an economic revival, and then destroyed by the civil war. Then they try to get back up again, and then they get Ebola. But as you say, a wonderful country and a wonderful people. And although we did support, we'd put a lot of work, I coordinated the deployment of NHS staff in support of the Ebola response in West Africa. But ultimately, it was the Sierra Leoneans who managed it and, you know, and got on top of it in the end.
We talked about natural disasters, you know, earthquakes, floods, that sort of thing. But when you're dealing with a disease like you did in Sierra Leone and also in Haiti, does that... How to phrase this? Does that worry you more? Because obviously, with an earthquake or with an explosion in the aftermath, there might be an aftershock, but you won't be expecting that. But when you're treating a massive outbreak of a disease and a killer one at that, does that not make you slightly more nervous? Or, I mean, not that you're all professional at all times, but does that give you more pause for thought before going in?
They all give me pause for thought. I mean, you talk about sudden onset disasters. I mean, even in earthquakes, I was at an earthquake in China 10 years ago. I was 13 floors up in the Department of Surgery when a 6.4 aftershock struck. And we all thought the building was coming down. And I actually thought, so this is how it ends. And it went on. The vibration was such that we couldn't see out of the windows because the glass was vibrating and frosted. Agreed. And the operating light that is screwed to the ceiling swung backwards and forwards because the roof was rippling. And we had to hold the patient onto the operating table. All the instruments fell off. So we do prepare people for aftershocks. But in disease outbreaks, there are a couple of things. You have to make sure your team is really well prepared. They have to understand the risks. They have to know all about infection prevention and control, how to use PPE. We will try our best to protect them. And then it's basic public health measures, which is test, trace, isolate, and support. Test and trace alone isn't going to do it. That just tells you where the disease is. It doesn't help you control it. You have to isolate people, which is the age-old way of controlling outbreaks. Quarantine, I don't know if your listeners are aware, but quarantine comes from the Italian for 40 days, where in Venice they used to isolate the ships when they came in to make sure the disease went. So it's test, trace, isolate. And then you've got to support people to stay at home. So an outbreak is much more of a... It's medicine, but it's public health medicine, and it's public health messaging. In Sierra Leone, it was important as well that we worked with local communities to get safe burial practices, because there's a strong tradition of washing the family members washing the body, but of course the body was highly infectious. And so you had to work with the local communities to ensure that burial practices were changed sensitively and still met their cultural requirements, but did not pose a risk to those who were managing the bodies.
Because that's another thing, is you have to have the cultural sensibilities of the area you're going into.
Absolutely.
As well.
Yeah, I always say it sounds a bit rough, but it's their disaster. It's their, you know, and you have to be invited in to help. And then if invited in, do what you're asked to do. You know, they have to manage it themselves and then use you as they see fit. And so we worked with the World Health Organization to set up what's called an Emergency Medical Teams Initiative, where you register your team, what your team can do. So we have the following capabilities. And then governments can say, well, actually, we need this, but we don't need that, and so on. So as they don't get overwhelmed with good intentions, but which are not really very helpful to them, and they have to manage them, they need it more accurately pinpointed, what the help it is that's on offer.
And presumably, you know, education is a vital part as well. Not against, well, to a certain extent, you know, building structures that can withstand aftershocks and whatever. But there's no point you going as a team, landing, doing what you can, and then getting out of dodge, pardon the vernacular, and then, you know, and the locals just going, okay, we'll just wait for the next time around. Presumably, you need to educate the local doctors and nurses and health professionals there.
Yeah, and we do, and we work together. I mean, I founded an international charity called UK Med about 30 years ago now, and we're working all the time. We're helping build capacity with colleagues in other countries, like COVID. Yes, we've responded to actually treat COVID patients, but we've also been working with other countries, particularly across Africa. At one time, we were in 17 different countries, helping them build up their system. How do you manage these outbreaks? So capacity building is a really important part of what we do.
We talk about the book. It's called Frontline, and as I said, it's not all doom and gloom. It's not all this terrible thing. It's not a ghoulish book by any means. What were the situations that looked the most desperate? But then because of yourself and the population that you were dealing with or helping, aiding, what are the most inspiring memories that you have from that, away from the nightmares that you talked about earlier? What are the ones that give you the greatest pleasure and said, you know, we did good, but then everybody did good? Because it's a book about people going part, you know, the humanity of man, which at the moment we seem to be a little bit sort of down on that particular one.
Yeah, we are. But I've always, I'd say, always been impressed. Yeah, I'm not starry-eyed about this. I know there are bad things happening, but overall, there's more good being done, and certainly the impact of people doing good is always greater. I've got many memories. I made enormous friends. I'm still in touch with people in Sarajevo. Still in touch with people in Kosovo. In fact, I'll be going back to Kosovo very soon. So I'm still in touch. But the best memory I have, if you like, is of setting up a field hospital on the Iran-Iraq border. And because of the political situation, and we were the only international team that was allowed in, as I said, the Iranians knew us, and so they invited us in. Aid was going in on the Turkish side and the other side, but only us could get in across the Iranian side, and went up to the top of this mountain. And we set up this field hospital all alone. We couldn't refer patients to anyone. It was just, we were the only care that could be given. And I have to say, and I'm proud of this, if you reached us alive, you stayed alive. Nobody died. We treated snake bites. We had an outbreak of typhoid. We had malaria. We had mine injuries. And when we first arrived, we were presented with two little baby girls, infants in their mother's arms, who, from my experience of working in richer countries, these babies were unconscious and arched rigid with what was obviously meningitis. Now, you rarely see that in the UK, and I thought they were going to die. Mm. But I instructed the team to put drips up, give them broad spectrum antibiotics, because we couldn't test for anything, just give them broad spectrum antibiotics. And then I worked throughout the night going around the camp and all that. And then when I came back in the morning, the cots where the children were empty. So I thought they must have died. But the nurse who was looking after them was smiling. And I looked again, they were on their mother's knees. They were still poorly, but they were clearly on the mend. And then they made a full recovery. And I thought, wow, just this little drop of medicine that is denied to so many people could have such a powerful effect. And that's always stayed with me. Don't give up, and just don't get blasé about the power of medicine, even simple, straightforward medicines, for those who have so little.
Why the book, and why now? Why did you decide to put it there, to put it all down?
A number of things. I'm 70 next month, so it seemed...
Well, how can I wish you a happy birthday from Space?
Thank you very much. So it seemed a good time to do it. And I say that because my children, who are all grown up with children, they didn't know much about what I'd done. My wife had always shielded them when they were younger from the details of what I was doing. They wanted to know more about it. And then I've got grandchildren now. And it was thought that they ought to know more. So I set about doing it. I had started some years ago when I was due to work for the United Nations to go to Mongolia to because there'd been a drought and then the crops had failed and to do an assessment of their health needs. But they moved the date of the trip, and it clashed with I was already committed to doing another job for them after the Nairobi bombing to go to Kenya. So they had to put somebody else in my place. And the helicopter crashed and he was killed. And I thought, and then there was nothing on the news about it. He was British, Gerard Leclerc from Guernsey. He was killed, nothing on the news. And I thought, nobody would know what the work he was doing and the risks he was taking. So I started writing about the work then, but then that got put to one side because I had work to do. So I had that in my mind. And then the children and the grandchildren wanted me to put something down. So I just started writing. I went through all my papers. I've kept all the reports going right back to Armenia. So I know things I say, even if things in the book appear critical of officialdom at times, it's there in black and white. I do have the record. And then we had the Nightingale experience and COVID. So I wrapped it all up in that.
Well, we're very glad you did. The book is called Frontline, Saving Lives in War, Disaster and Disease. It's by Dr. Tony Redmond, who we've been speaking to today. Tony, if people want to find out more about you or about the book, do you have time to do it as the social media or the web even?
I do Twitter, yeah, and it's at Anthony D. Redmond, all one word.
Well,
Anthony with an H.
Anthony with an H. It's been a pleasure to speak to you today. You'll be able to download the book as well from our virtual bookstore. But Dr. Tony Redmond, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much.